Hi there. So if you are tuning in, you are listening to the voice of Shazia Nurali, one half of the Color Gap podcast. And I'm doing this episode as a solo episode because this is a really deeply personal reflection episode for me. And it was not an easy one to write and to produce and record. And definitely something that is uncomfortable for me to talk about. It is all about confronting my anti-white sentiment. And I want to take you on a little bit of a journey of the experiences and the perspective of a woman of color navigating the world where the entire existence has been defined in some ways by the white people in my life and how that has influenced my perspective on the ways in which white privilege shows up in waves in the world and in people around me. And as a person of color, you know, my, like I said, entire existence has been defined in some way by the white people in my life, whether they were white leaders, white politicians, white beauty standards even, and white voices have been at the forefront of important experiences and influences throughout my entire life. And as I've come to find this value in my own voice, my own presence, my identity, and my worth as a woman of color, what I struggle with now is reconciling the depth of that influence and its impact on me, both the good as well as the bad. And I've recently come to a point of deep reflection around how this, I guess, oversaturation of white influence has impacted my life. You know, with the wake of the racial injustice movement coming to a head in the US and the conversations in my own backyard around really affording Black and Indigenous people the dignity to respect their histories and their stories, the majority of the spotlight has actually obviously been on white people, both as allies as well as resistors in recognizing their own privilege. I mean, everywhere we turn, there is a conversation these days on white fragility and white privilege and owning up to that. And it's also been a realization for me that as much as I have, you know, deep gratitude for the white allies, the white leaders, the white teachers, and many white friends in my life, but I also carry a little bit of resentment and frustration for those white people in my journey and in my experience that have held positions of power and failed for years to recognize their privilege or do something with it. And I recognize that perhaps I do have some anti-white sentiment to reconcile within myself. You know, I preface all of this with the fact that I also live in Alberta, oil country, a predominantly white populated province where any Facebook posts related to politics, immigration, COVID, Trump, Trudeau, or anything related to our facing our province's own realities on race and white privilege are often met with really deep and visceral hate that's really rooted in the truest definition of white supremacy. And just as a side note, never read the comments section on Facebook or elsewhere because you'll be guaranteed to feel less hopeful about the state of humanity. You know, I grew up as a person of color in what was then a primarily white dominated area of the city, and was then and is still now a very much lower income neighborhood. And I was the target of racism on many occasions growing up. You know, kids on the playground, being called a packy, all of the different things that you can imagine being different. I also have a father who, to make ends meet, did everything he could to provide for his kids, including being the stereotype of the Pakistani immigrant cab driver. And I really hustled to get to where I am today. I started working at 14 years old. I paid my entire way through earning 2 degrees, and I'm now the proud owner of an advanced degree. I'm a successful professional by all accounts. I'm a homeowner and someone who has literally never had leaders who looked anything like me as role models in my career path to pave the way or show me it could be done. I say all of this to really paint a picture of what so many of us push through to gain access to the same spaces and places and positions as our white counterparts. I say this because, you know, the biggest difference between a white girl who came up, from a lower income family and pushed her way to success is that she likely got there a little bit faster and a little bit easier because she had far more access to role models that looked like her, to leaders and politicians and beauty standards that were all there to aspire to, and that were actually all accessible to her in some way, shape, or form. And it came to a head a few months back for me, and like probably many of you, I sat in absolute horror watching the US presidential debate and what felt like this intense display of pettiness, immaturity, and outright disrespect in the conversation that felt like the equivalent of what my dear friend Steph called out as two old men fighting over the last pudding at the seniors' home. You know, in jest, I posted a photo on my Instagram stories of the Simpsons grandpa. If you're not familiar with the Simpsons, just picture an old, arguably, slightly senile white man fighting against himself. And I notated it with the caption that stated, "When you go male, pale, and stale, the case for diversity has never been stronger." I had a chuckle to myself thinking I was being really cheeky and calling out what all my Black, Indigenous, and people of color friends and followers were probably thinking. But I was quickly reminded by a dear friend who happens to identify as white that using the same approach, calling someone pale and using that as a derogatory term to cut down, my perceived enemy, it's the same approach as those that believe in white supremacy didn't. And it doesn't make me much better than them. In fact, it makes me just like them. And that was sobering, to say the least. It's not an easy pill to swallow. I definitely pride myself on being a kind, empathetic, and self-aware person that doesn't like the idea of fighting fire with fire. Yet I found myself on countless occasions through this podcast platform and other arenas really pitting myself and other racialized people against the white people in my sphere of influence. Now, those are not usually those that are in my inner circle. I have some incredible leaders and friends and people in that circle that I highly respect and look up to. But using the exact weapon that I'm fighting against, fear and hate, to gain some sense of control and power that has never really been afforded to me and other Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And what got us in this position in the first place is letting fear take the wheel and letting hate that has been rooted in centuries of fear to drive the bus. And look how little progress that has provided us in the conversation on race. There is a definite balance between holding people accountable for their actions, but while also looking to advance the dialogue through empathy, kindness, and the connection to the human experience that actually binds us all. However, it's damn hard to remember that when we're in the midst of what seems to be a never-ending test on humanity. And fast forward to mid-November of 2020, when I once again had the space and the courage to pick up writing out this piece again. And we're now aware that over 70 million Americans either ignored their moral compass to vote Donald Trump back into office, or simply have no regard for the state of humanity and the impact of the racist, sexist, and downright inhumane spewings of a man who holds the most powerful platform in the world. And just because I'm Canadian does not mean the evils and the actions of those in power in the US don't impact me and all of us. After all, if we're really clear, we aren't that much different than them. We have politicians in our own backyard in positions of power and influence who have themselves rallied for Trump and see pushing their moral compass aside in favor of upholding their own power and privilege as unaffected by the work they do as public servants. In addition, the numbers of minorities and women who voted for this monster to retain power are absolutely mind-boggling to me, but they don't make up the majority. The white men and women who fail to understand the impact of their individualistic perspectives and the power of their choice to validate and re-empower the man that has made it okay to use fear, hate, and pathological lying to get ahead. And it's simply something I just can't wrap my head around. I scream to myself, how is this okay? I deeply desire, trust me, I do, to reach into my heart and find the space to seek to understand. Yet in my mind, those people are so rooted in their privilege and fear that they could never see me as a human who has the same hopes, same desires, dreams, and wishes for my life and those of the people that I love. Yet people like me who navigate the world from such different access, a place of fear, a lack of belonging. Do those people understand that? Will they ever see my pain? Will they ever see the pain of millions of Black, Indigenous people of color who are trying to catch up and own their own space in the world in the same exact way? You know, and as I'm grappling through all of these feelings, out comes a really deep and profound reminder. I was driving home from my parents' place on a recent Sunday morning. Yes, they are in my bubble. And something in me told me to turn on Brené Brown's podcast with Elizabeth Lesser. So if you don't know Elizabeth Lesser, she is a best-selling author and co-founder of the Omega Institute. I don't have a commute these days, you know, outside of my bedroom to my home office. And I live in like a 700 square foot condo. So you can imagine that that's not particularly long. So I relish any opportunity to listen to podcasts to pass time in my car while doing more than just getting annoyed at the lackluster options on local radio stations. You know, and my phone was on 10% battery life, but I was committed. And that car is old enough to not have any ability to charge something as futuristic as an iPhone. But I was willing to risk it for some inspiration in my 20-minute drive home. And throughout the conversation, Brené and Elizabeth go deep into dialogue on what Elizabeth calls confronting my own bullshit when it comes to how we respond to the evils in the world, like crazy timely. She says, because sometimes the very evils that we want to fight in the world, the broken behaviors we blame on others, are also alive in us and in need of our attention, our kindness, our understanding, and our healing. You know, when you have one of those moments when you feel like God has spoken to you, it's wild and it stopped me in my tracks. It was an aha moment to remember that we can't get to a place of understanding, of kindness, of empathy, and of progress on the conversation on race without reconciling our own understanding of humanity and how our own hate and visceral reactions to the actions of one should not be painted to the actions and values of all within that group. Of course, it's not lost on me that, you know, such a reminder and a moment of clarity has come from two very outwardly privileged white women, and that myself being first generation Pakistani Canadian means I also have a depth of privilege that affords me the opportunity to step back and seek out those lessons. You know, I don't fear the same oppression, violence, and injustice that Black and Indigenous people throughout North America feel. I don't have years and years of generational trauma at the hands of those in the white majority to reconcile for myself. It feels almost like my lesson borders on the same vein as when white people give racists a pass without thinking about the impact on the target of that hate, simply because they believe that person is a good person or has, you know, Black friends or is in a relationship with a person of color. So what I say comes with the knowledge that I have far more space to create energy around meeting people where they are and looking for opportunities to remove what this term that I love that Brené Brown uses calls the common enemy intimacy factor when I'm seeking solutions. And what are those solutions? To me, it starts with humanizing people. First, listening to and validating the stories of Black and Indigenous people who have been at the target of thousands of years of hate to understand how they, despite the countless barriers against them, despite the generational trauma, their lack of access to opportunities, rights, freedoms, and even the decency and dignity, you know, to live, have found their way through. That's where it starts for me, for not only white people, but also for myself. Listening to the trauma from a place of learning, from a place of empathy and kindness. It also means, and more importantly, being an advocate for work that is rooted in anti-racism, that doesn't allow anyone to sit on the sidelines and observe, but requires us all to actively engage in calling out discrimination, inequity, and racism, and using our individual platforms and privilege to advance the conversation beyond the surface. It means being really thoughtful about how we use our individual spaces of privilege to seek to understand, and knowing that not all racist people are savable or self-aware enough to understand the root of their hate Some are, and in the impeccable words of Michelle Obama, that we all know, when they go low, we go high. She goes on to say that going high doesn't mean you don't feel the hurt or you're not entitled to an emotion. It means that your response has to reflect the solution. It shouldn't come from a place of anger or vengefulness. Anger may feel good in the moment, but it's not going to move the ball forward. Like, mic drop right there for the impeccable Michelle Obama. Her words are just so meaningful there, and I want that to really sink in. It is about the response and it is about the solution. Coming from a place of vengefulness and anger only gets us so far. And as for me, I acknowledge that I have my own anti-white sentiment to resolve, and I'm standing in my own worth now. And that actually creates more opportunity for connected and meaningful exchanges that aren't always rooted in a power dynamic where absolutely nobody wins. My approach moving forward is really active and not passive. And it requires me to be really, really highly aware of the natural spaces of hate and anger I can go to in my mind when I see things like terrorism and white supremacy on display in the most visceral of ways, like we all witnessed in the US Capitol insurrection recently. It's not about a dog-eat-dog world, and not an ounce of progression will ever happen if I choose to be part of the blame game or engage in any sort of mind revenge tactics. I choose to speak my truth, and I choose to lean into the privileges that I've been afforded to advance the voices of other Black, Indigenous people of color. And I choose to actively stop myself from going low, even in the face of unforeseeable injustice. Yes, there will always be those that choose to operate out of a space of hate, but I don't have to join them there, and neither do you.